Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Churchill, the great orator. A Telegraph podcast in association with Universal Pictures' Darkest Hour. Episode 4, The Man Behind the Mask. Gary Oldman and Joe Wright in conversation with Robbie Collin.
So I'm here talking to Gary Oldman about his performance as Winston Churchill and Darkest Hour's director, Joe Wright. Gary, I want to start by asking you about Churchill as an orator and if there were any particular details in the style and method of his speech making that particularly caught your imagination as an actor.
The first thing I worked on was the voice and enlisted a singing teacher and opera singer, Richard E. Dean. And we worked out on the keyboard the range of Churchill. So from the highest note that he would hit to the lowest. And partly the challenge of playing Churchill, I mean, and there were many, but one of them was, of course, this very iconic sound and a very particular voice that he had, and especially in the oratory. If you think of a bad impersonation of Churchill, people remember it as this sort of da 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 da, and he's got this sort of there is a certain way that he will express words that's almost like a signature, and there's a cadence and a rhythm to the way that he speaks when he's publicly speaking to, and there's a nasality as well, so that when you're breaking it down as an actor, you're listening for the rhythm and then the cadence of how he's expressing it. And then, of course, he had a slight speech impediment, so he had a lisp. And then also it was a little adenoidal, so it would, if that's a word, and it came down through the nose. And these are the sort of things that you, as an actor anyway, you sort of pick up on, and then you start sort of really like a muscle you have to exercise, you start to work on it every day. So I went to the speeches, but some of them, as you know, were recorded after the event, and I'm not sure whether the BBC went to Chartwell and stuck a microphone under his nose, and he was in bed. So I was a little presumptuous, but figured that he would not have, in quotes, performed them or spoken them like that in the house, in the moment, in front of 600 people. So we get this sort of dry, rather repetitive sort of delivery. But I took that as a template, and then in the actual performing of them, the speeches, I gave it a little pinch of Henry V. The biggest nod that I got was from a guy called Michael Bishop, who runs the Churchill Library in Washington, D.C. And he said, you know, wow, we don't really have a recording of him doing them, only after the event. But he certainly, as one of the sort of Churchill scholars or Churchill experts, he certainly felt he got his money's worth.
To me, it felt like hearing the live versions of songs that I knew the studio recordings of very well. But there was a new kind of friction and spark to them that I hadn't heard before. And it's interesting you mention that, the lisp and the adenoidal aspect of the voice, because those are things that in impersonations of Churchill I hadn't previously picked up on. And what I love about what you do with this performance is it's not a straight impersonation. It's very much your take as an actor on Churchill as a character.
It has to be ultimately a creation rather than an impersonation. Apart from the reading material on him, which is, I mean, voluminous. I mean, I'm still reading about him and will continue to read about him until my last breath, I think. My curiosity about him is such that it will extend and beyond just Darkest Hour and the film. I'd even like another crack at him. Maybe with the conferences, you know, and have Stalin, Churchill and Roosevelt sort of dividing up the world, maybe down the line, you know, and play him at the end of the war. I just absolutely loved playing him so much. But the key to me was going to the newsreel footage. And the revelation was that here was this man who was so dynamic, so full of life, so full of energy, marching ahead, moving through space with this fixity of purpose, this man on a mission with the sparkle in his eye, a cherubic face that you almost felt that any moment he could turn to the cameraman and wink, you know. And that was so removed from this curmudgeon, this man born in a bad mood, you know, dropping cigar ash on his waistcoat, you know, and shuffling around in his carpet slippers. This was a dynamo of a character, and working on him, that was the thing that whatever hesitation that I had about playing an icon or a mythologized figure, and the fact that other very wonderful actors had played him before, the thing that excited me was discovering that and thinking, that's who I want to play, this man with a real glint in his eye and a humour. There's actually one very, very key piece of footage that for me kind of unlocked the door. He's giving a speech. It's probably just after the war, I would think. And I saw it so long ago now that I can't remember. But it was one of these speeches that he was giving to some guild, you know. And it was a big packed house, and he gets a slight frog in his throat, and he reaches for a glass of water. And he takes a sip of this water, and then with a big smile on his face says, "I don't often do that." And he brings the house down, you know, because they know he drinks, you know, and he lived that up. And played it up, you know, like Dean Martin used to do. It was a real moment. It was a few seconds, but you just go, there's the man, there he is, you know, that is self-effacing and has got, just a wonderful humour.
In terms of capturing that glint and also the cherubic look that you described earlier, did prosthetics, was that always going to be a part of this role? Because, you know, to have done that through this extra layer on top of your natural face, what particular challenges did that present?
Well, initially, when they first approached me about it, I thought, oh, come on, don't be ridiculous. You know, how am I going to do that? And it had never obviously been on a... I don't have a bucket list of characters to play, but, Dracula was never on my list of things to play, but it came across my desk and it was Francis Ford Coppola, and I thought, oh, well, that would be interesting. So these things come in, they're incoming calls. Yet the challenge of the physicality was always going to be an issue. I had worked with the makeup designer, Kazuhiro Tsuji. I'd worked with him 20 years ago. He had head cast me for something that I actually ended up not being in, but had followed his work. He has since retired from the movie industry and now is a sort of, he's a bit kind of like, do you know the guy Ron Muick who
yes.
does those? Yeah. Kazuhiro does these portraits and they're hyper-realistic and they're huge heads of people that he makes. And I knew his work and said to Joe Wright, I'm nearly 60. I was not going to put on 70 pounds. I'd spend the rest of my life losing weight. Also, the health issue involved. So I said, look, the only way to go is going to be makeup. And this is really the only man on the planet who could even remotely pull it off. If we can get him, that's the guy. And it wasn't completely contingent on Kazu's availability, but it was very important to get him because I felt that he would be the only one who could do it. And and the stars aligned, and it worked out. It was a trial and error. We went for a version that was sort of what I call full Churchill. It was very good, but it looked a little odd. It looked like Churchill and Gary Oldman had had this sort of strange love child. It was strange, but we knew that tweaking and pulling back. At one point, I think he resculpted the jowls. And it was over time, I think we got there.
Joe, last time we spoke, it was about a year ago, and it was the morning that you'd just taken delivery of Gary Oldman's facial prosthesis, and you were in a buoyant mood, and now we know why.
I was very excited that day. I mean, we had spent, I think, 6 months working on the prosthetics for Gary's transformation. And it had been, there'd been many iterations. At first, we'd gone too far and he looked like he had a dead chicken on his face. And then we didn't go far enough. And so finally, I hope we hit a sweet spot where he looked enough like Churchill, but still the prosthetics allowed access for the audience to engage with his performance.
It was enormously liberating. It was the most free I've ever been in front of a camera.
How so?
While I was hidden, so I could hide, I think that for sure, there's a certain, if you've ever been to a fancy dress party or a Halloween thing, you wear a mask and there's a sort of liberation to it. You feel something, you're less inhibited. It gives you a confidence. So I think that was an aspect of it.
How important was getting Churchill's physical presence? Because that presence is an enormous part of his myth as a politician, as a historical figure.
It's interesting, you know, I think he's one of the first politicians to really understand branding before it was, you know, before it was a thing. And so the kind of the silhouette, the brand of Churchill is certainly one of the most iconic in political history. So you needed to get it right, but also there are certain, you know, misconceptions about the way he looked. At this point in the war, he wasn't nearly as fat as he was at the end of the war. I think he might have been a kind of nervous eater. It was important to get the right figure, really, but also to look beyond the caricature.
Why do you think that brand's endured in the way that it has done? Because, and not just in terms of his physical form, but the idea of the cadence in his speeches, you know, these are the way in which Churchill spoke. Politicians today still try to emulate that with varying degrees of success.
He was a great self-publicist, unfortunately, because I think people have still tried to, if they're not tried to kind of copy his brand, they're still trying to brand themselves, and politics has become more and more about, you know, personality rather than principles. Churchill had both. I guess, you know, he became the icon, the figurehead, the symbol of British tenacity and the bulldog breed, as they put it, you know. We like to identify ourselves with him.
Joe loves rehearsal. So we had 4 weeks where we got up and physicalized and vocalized the text and worked out little, if there were tweaks or problems or historical things that weren't necessarily, you know, accurate, or questions or whatever, we chewed it around, and it was great to work with Kristen and you know, Malcolm Story, Stephen Delane, Sam West, to really move it around. You don't get that in film. I've been in productions where I have met the guy, you know, the director, the night before going on the set. You meet an actress that morning and she's playing your wife, and you have to sort of convey a, you know, a 12-year marriage, or, you know, and you've really only known her half an hour. It's very weird how we make movies. I'm amazed that any of them are any good. The way we put them together. I had 8 months to work on this. I learned all the speeches first, the big speeches I got down. And by the time I got to rehearsal, I knew it like a play, so I didn't really have to search for the words. They become, they're just sort of in your DNA. It's a strange process. And you were saying about like not doing an impersonation. You get to, you know, we got all this, these wonderful sort of behind the velvet rope tours of Chartwell and Blenheim and the War Room and Downing Street. And with the listening to the recordings, watching the footage, reading the books on Churchill, you take all of that and somehow metabolize it. You take those experiences and then turn the intellectual side of it into a sensation. It's about feeling and sensation. I can't really describe it beyond that. It when you're looking for that sound that he made, you just have to feel it somewhere in your mouth, you know. It's I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. It's just what we do.
When you were looking at those qualities, what was it that then made you make the mental leap to Gary Oldman, who is not, you know, wonderful actor that he is not the person that most people, I think, would instinctively cast as Churchill?
Yeah, the Churchill that I saw, contrary to a lot of other depictions of him, you know, he's often depicted as this kind of grumpy curmudgeon, as if he'd been born with in a bad mood, you know. And the Churchill that I saw in my research and in the screenplay was someone who was kind of manic with energy. He thought at 500 miles an hour. No one could keep up with him. He had this kind of intensity that was so intense that sometimes it would break down into utter collapse. I don't like to diagnose him, but if I was pushed to, I would say that he was probably a manic depressive, you know. Gary is someone, as we know from all of his kind of extraordinary performances, is someone capable of that level of intensity and vigor. Also, he's like, you know, I mean, he's the best actor in the world as far as I'm concerned, and so why wouldn't one want him to play the role? And I think the essence is far harder to fake than the exterior. He fully inhabits the role, and he spent 6 months, if not more, in his kind of studio at the back of his house, practicing being Winston Churchill. I mean, literally practicing, walking up and down, saying the lines, thinking about it, trying it again. He would send me recordings of himself making those speeches, you know, months before we ever started. And so he was able to completely lose himself in that character, to the extent where it was difficult to tell where Gary ended and Churchill began, or vice versa, you know. It's by no means an impersonation. It's very much an inhabitation, a kind of shape-shifting inhabitation.
Given that you're a director who's known for using long rehearsal periods, I mean long in filmmaking terms, what point in the rehearsals did Gary start wearing the costumes, the prosthetics?
Day one.
Right.
Literally. I mean, we were a bit naughty, but it was very exciting. On the first day of rehearsals, I always start with a read through, so the entire cast is called, even if they just have one line or whatever. And Gary decided that he was going to come in full makeup and costume. So everyone arrived. Everyone was sat around this big table, waiting for Gary Oldman, and instead of Gary Oldman, Winston Churchill arrived, and it was a brilliant move, because immediately everyone upped their game. Everyone understood what they were getting involved with. I think literally most of them all kind of stood to attention as he walked in and gasped.
Churchill, the great orator. In association with Universal Pictures' Darkest Hour.
You spoke about getting to know those speeches very, very well before filming. And what really interested me about the screenplay is it's built around those speeches. You know, you start with the maiden speech to Parliament as Prime Minister. Then you have the BE Men of Valour, yeah, the broadcast, the first broadcast, yeah, to the nation. And then it ends, of course, post-Dunkirk, with the We Shall Fight Them on the Beaches. What did you see developing in Churchill's character between those three speeches that you were able to, I mean, perhaps even stuff that you saw on your tours of the historical locations and your reading, that perhaps didn't even take place within the span of the film itself, but you were able to draw on and sort of plant seeds in these speeches and think, okay, so this is perhaps chiming with that, and this somehow relates to or foreshadows something still to come.
And what I think is particularly sort of masterful, not only in the writing, but also in the oratory, in the speaking of them. He has there's a set of defeats, and he has to be, a modern word, I guess. Now we call it transparency, but he has to be sort of honest, and yet always support the theme of victory. And that's a very hard thing to do in the final big speech of, you know, we shall fight them on the beaches, for instance, he has to let us know that there is a defeat in France, but don't despair, because hope is around the corner, and ultimately we will win. And he's doing this sort of very it's a sort of very delicate kind of juggling act he's doing. He has to deliver as the information is coming to him, and he is sort of transposing that and working that and turning it into basically information, not only for the cabinet, the government, but also for the British people. It's always that there's also a great sense of it's like a counter thing of buoyancy and hope and encouragement and ultimate victory. And I think that is its sort of, that's at least one of its themes running through them. The way he can give you a blow, he can hit you in the face, and then it's like he can sort of hit you in the face and then tickle you in the belly. I don't know what it is. It's like a wonderful thing he does, you know. If that's a, is that a good way of describing it? I don't know, yeah.
His faults were often his greatest attributes. Taking Gallipoli as an example, you know, it was his will that pushed that policy through. It was a good idea to start with. Then everyone prevaricated. They lost the element of surprise, and yet Churchill nevertheless pushed the policy, and it ended in disaster and the deaths of many, many men. It's that same will that then stood up against Hitler in 1940 and refused to sign that peace deal finally. It's that same will that stood behind the Battle of Britain. And so I find that kind of fascinating, the way in which often our faults become our attributes.
It's really interesting to me how over the course of the film, which is built around three speeches that were made over the course of 4 weeks, right, you can see that will becoming more concentrated and solidifying in the face of this opposition from abroad and also in his own cabinet. Can you tell me a bit about what building a film just around these three speeches, rather than giving us Churchill's life story, what particular essence you were able to get at about him by focusing on this very, very narrow slice? I mean, very eventful, but very narrow slice of his life.
I think details are often more telling than kind of broad strokes, really. At the war rooms, there is a chair in which he sat in the war cabinet room. And it's got this kind of gash in the arm, in the wood of the arm of the chair.
Have you sat in the chair? I've been in the chair at the war room.
I haven't.
The curator let me sit in that chair. And you know, you were talking earlier about building a character or putting a character together. On the left-hand arm of the chair are these divots from his fingernails, like literally, like deep scratches where he was like doing this. And on the right hand side of the chair is all the scratches from his ring, from the tapping. And it wasn't like he was in that chair every day during the war. He was only down there intermittently. But that behavior is in now, it's a, like a living thing, you know, it's like in this piece of furniture. And that can tell you so much about the psychology of an individual. I wouldn't have discovered that if he hadn't have let me in and sit down. And the moment that you put your hand there like that, you can feel all these ridges where his fingernails would scratch at the chair.
That detail tells me so much more about Churchill's character and what he was going through at that time, that kind of nervous tension and energy, tells me so much more than you know, chapters of a big biopic, but also looking at this specific character of trying to understand who this person was, rather than, you know, taking him off the plinth in Parliament Square, where he kind of surveys the traffic, taking down off that plinth and trying to meet him as a human being, you know, and therefore learn from him.
My appreciation of Winston Churchill, yes, I knew a bit about Churchill. I've got a book on my shelf I've had for years of stories and the witty quotes and all of that. But when you really look at the achievement in one life, you know, it was like he lived the life of five men. You know, the 50 books, I mean, more words than Shakespeare and Dickens put together, you know, 540-something paintings, 16 exhibitions at the Royal Academy, a Nobel Prize for Literature, you know, he occupied every major position, almost every one in politics, a prime minister twice, took us through the war, was commended in the First World War, you know, it's mind-boggling. The achievement. I can't imagine. You meet the king, and he says, "Will you accept?" And you go, "Yeah." And there you are. You're the prime minister. You inherit now this mess, an unintentional one. I like to think that Chamberlain was the right man at the wrong time. And Churchill was the right man at the right time, because he wanted, don't we all want that? You know, that's what a legacy, you know, peace is a wonderful thing. But Churchill comes in, he inherits this mess, and then very soon he's got a possibility of an invasion, an imminent invasion by Nazi Germany. He's got the entire British army that are trapped in Dunkirk, with the Germans advancing on them. He's got resistance in his own cabinet. And he's also got to take care of domestic policy. I mean, it just doesn't go away because there's a war on. My God. And then of course, the famous letter, which we use at the beginning of the movie, where Kristen comes in, Clementine says to him, you know, you're being intolerable and I want people to appreciate you, because you're a much nicer man than you're being right now. We stole it from somewhere else. It was later on in the war when he was really under the gun and he was really snapping at people and shouting and being quite a bully. And she wrote the letter, I think, didn't send it, tore it up, and then decided to give it to him and then stuck it together with sellotape and then handed it to him. Look at what he was facing. You know, he's incomparable. There's no one. I can't think of anyone. You know, Lincoln, perhaps, Washington. You know, no one can touch him.
There also seem to be moments where events, fictionalized events in the script, seem to foreshadow things that happen in the future. The encounter on the underground train when he's on the way to Westminster and he stops to talk to the electorate for a while. Yeah. Now that's a fictionalised event, but you have the situation with the little girl saying to him, you know, we shall never give up. Mm. And to me that was almost like planting a seed for the school commencement speech that was to come years later, the famous never, never, never give up line.
It's an Achilles heel for some, you know, the underground. But you're right in as much that it is it's a foreshadowing of his relationship with the British people. And I personally think is it sentimental? Is it sort of a bit on the sentimental side? Yeah, a tad. But I thought that it was a very lyrical way of showing that relationship with the people. it's like a little candy bar, you know, there you are. And it does, and it, I think it was, I'd like to think it was intentional that Anthony gives us that little, just a little taste of things to come.
Having spoken to Anthony about this script, I'm absolutely certain that that was his design, because he was very, very careful about where all these beats happened, and that this seemed very deliberately placed in order to tee up a life beyond this very short part of Churchill's existence that the film deals with.
Yeah, and things come into the script. I think the original line to me was, "Are you upset?" And I went to Anthony, I went to Joe, and I said, I found this little quote I think it was maybe Elizabeth Nell's diary, who is our Elizabeth Layton, Lily James in the movie. And I said, there's just this little reference to him saying, you know, I blub a lot. You'll have to get used to it. And he would cry over a puppy or a kitten or someone on the street or a kid or, a bird with a broken wing or even a dead fish floating to the surface in his pond. And there was a real sort of soft, very vulnerable side to him. And I suggested, what about that? If she said, are you crying? Instead of, are you upset? And it was, sometimes you just have those opportunities or those moments in a picture where you can go, you know, we don't need to invent a line here. He actually said this. So it's a nice little, I think a nice little touch. It's always nice when you can put in a little bit of, even at the beginning of the script, it was a note of mine that Joe Armstrong says about, Klopp. I love the thing. I like the idea that he gave things pet name.
And this was his hole punch.
And that was his hole punch. And I guess it was the noise that it made when it punched. Klopp, and he called it a Klopp. I love the cat under the bed. Improv'd. Yeah, on the day. The cat was not being a very good actor and wouldn't do what it was told, and it would hide under the bed. So I said to Joe, what about if I'm trying to get the cat from under the bed? And he went, oh, I love that. Okay, and we'll keep that. Okay, let's do that. So there are accidents. The corgi, the dog, we were doing a wide shot. We're eating this lunch. Maybe three shots in, the dog got off of the sofa, came around to me here and started sort of looking at me. And so in the scene, I just fed him. And then Joe said, I love it, keep the dog in. And then when we went in for the close-up, we did the thing with the dog, every time. But some of it's planned and some of it is accidental. And that's the fun. I mean, I've done that motion capture larky. And you're loose, and it's but at the end of the day, someone's going to paint in the sky and make the leaves look really lovely, or they can. You're God, you can make it rain, you can make it snow, you can whatever you want to do. And the great thing about that I love about filming is the accidents like that, the things that happen that you can't write, that you can't predict. That's the exciting thing, is that you come to work every day. Yes, you have a script, but basically you have a blank canvas and you have 12 hours and you got to make something happen. You got to paint something. So it's thrilling. Elizabeth Nell was one of the secretaries of Winston Churchill, who I believe may have joined him, I think, in the middle of the war and then followed him through until the end and was, I think, one of his favourite secretaries. He had, he burned through a few, wore a few out, and I'm told that on a particularly creative night, he would always demand two girls tonight. I'll need a double shift because he was going to work until about 3 or 4 in the morning.
And clearly there's an enormous amount of source material to plough through to prepare for something like this, not only Churchill's own writings, but the writings about him, the recordings, the newspaper images and reports of the time. Were there any particular telling details in those, even ones that fell out with the scope of the film itself, that you thought, hang on, I can use this, I can somehow just plant this as a seed in what we're doing?
His humour, I find, to be wonderfully revealing. I think Winston used humour to combat the more uncomfortable elements of life, as we all do. You know, I mean, that's why humour is generally about sex and death, the things that make us feel uncomfortable. Every account by those closest to him, all these accounts talk about his humour and how laughter was always just behind the eyes and how he used humour as a defence. And so that felt very important to me. And which is why, you know, because we all do, don't we? We use humour in that way. And I think anything that any movie that doesn't have humour in it isn't really true to life.
Was there a particular joke that when you were reading around that just thought, you know, this sums up exactly his particular view of the world?
Just how irreverential his humour was. I love the one about, you know, when his secretary comes to him and tells him that the Privy Council is outside to see him, and he says, tell the Lord Privy Council I'm stuck in the Privy and can only deal with one shit at a time. I like that one.
Did your own opinion of Churchill change over the course of making the film? I mean, aside from all the extra things you learned about him, the biographical details, your understanding of his position in British culture as this kind of almost mythic figure today?
Yeah, I grew to love him. But I kind of do that with all the characters I make films about. You know, I think my responsibility is almost to love them and then express that love so that other people can feel it too. You know, so I grew to love his humanity. I grew to love his insecurities. I grew to love his empathy for others. I think he was an intensely empathetic person. And I grew to sympathise with the weight of the responsibility that he had on his shoulders, you know. And I think it's important to remember that these people are just human, you know, that they have faults and they have... and that, therefore, when they do triumph, as Churchill did, that's a human triumph.
One doesn't set out to make a topical film that is, you know, relevant. I mean, this, as you said that you've spoken to Anthony, you know, the seed of the idea came from those, you know, he wrote 3 speeches over 4 weeks, and Anthony said, why? How come? What? So the germ of the idea, I mean, is 6 years old, and there was no election and there was no Brexit. There were no, all these things in the world weren't around. Even in his own diary, this back and forth with Halifax. So just how close we came to really surrender. I mean, they were calling it a peace deal, but it would have essentially, I think, been... would have been, that's what it was. It was a surrender. They're reminded of what great leadership and great statesman looks like, you know. No one, as she says, no one can put words together like you, sir.
Hey, Gary Oldman, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Joel, thank you very much indeed.
My absolute pleasure.
To make sure you don't miss an episode of Churchill, the Great Orator, subscribe on iTunes or your preferred podcast host. And please do leave us a review.
Churchill, the Great Orator, the Man Behind the Mask, was produced by Sue Bowerman. It was a Blanket production for The Telegraph.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.